Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, 9th of September, and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of the daily Construction Index online news service. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good as ever.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. On to the news. News of the week. There hasn't been an awful lot of it, apart from the fact that COVID-19 seems to be making a bit of a comeback. Especially amongst
They're supposed to be excited about the start of HS2, but I thought it already started. So this official starting date, which they announced last Friday or Saturday or whatever it was, sounds to me like just a photo opportunity. So I think we should ignore it.
I think we should. And I can't say that I really paid much attention to that, especially as the enabling works have been going on for months already. So, yeah, I think that's just a bit of flag waving there.
Nothing wrong with that. But anything interesting come into your mailbox this week? Any interesting post?
Generally speaking, no. But I did have one email with a press release, which I thought was completely irrelevant. Well, it was totally irrelevant, and I was about to ditch it. And then I suddenly noticed that actually that it wasn't entirely irrelevant to discussions that we've had on this podcast previously. It was an email from a publisher, specifically a publisher of a series of books called Perfect Pets. Books.
Well, why were they sending it to you then?
I have a theory, but I'll come on to that. It's just published a new guide entitled Which Dog? An Essential Guide to Britain's Most Popular Breeds. And I just thought, well, this is not one for me because, although I've got a dog, I'm not a dog person, and I haven't been online Googling dogs or dog breeds recently. And it came through to my work email as well. It didn't come through to my personal email. Anyway, they've obviously published this book. It's a nice, glossy book, beautifully illustrated, as all new books always seem to be. But the spin they put on it was that lockdown has brought a variety of changes to our lives. And for many families, adding a new canine friend has been a popular choice due to lockdown and months of isolation. And that's where I began to put two and two together, because I don't know if you remember, but one of our very earliest podcasts, in fact, on the 25th of March, the week that Boris Johnson announced the lockdown.
This is my tip for surviving lockdown, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right,
my
yes.
My top tip for surviving lockdown.
Top tips. And in fact, your second rule for home working was
get a dog.
On the basis, I think you said that it forces you to get up in the morning because you've got to feed them and to get out of the house because you've got to walk them. Well,
yes. Otherwise, you're just going from bed to desk to sofa to bed in a continual cycle of never actually standing on your feet. Except
no, exactly. That's exactly true. And I think that what must have happened is that the enormous popularity of reconstruction has extended beyond the confines of the UK construction industry. And we've got listeners all over the world. Well, anyway, all over the business world. And somebody obviously heard you say that you've got to get a dog in the lockdown. And in fact, that's why they've sent us this. But it seems that not only have they picked up on it, but you were absolutely right. This is loads of other people have said exactly the same thing. It was research done by Ipsos Mori, so it's bona fide research, I assume, for an investment firm called Letter One. I don't know why they commissioned the research. But their comment was that nearly half of all Brits who currently own a pet got at least one new furry friend during lockdown, and 10% of British households currently without pets intend to get one in the next 6 months. So you're absolutely right. You foresaw that trend.
I read this week that shares in Pets at Home had leapt this week when their April and May sales went up beyond analyst expectations. So Pets at Home are benefiting from this. As a responsible dog owner, I feel I should have added the caveat when I issued my earlier call for everyone to get a dog if you're working from home. It is important, as this book suggested, to do your research. A plumber friend of mine a couple of years ago got himself a puppy because he thought, like so many people, nice to have a dog. He got himself a Jack Russell, which, like all Jack Russells, is a gallon and pint pot.
Yes.
And he'd leave it at home, go to work. And, of course, it tore the place to shreds. So he thought, well, that doesn't work. I have to take him in the van with me, which he thought was a much better idea anyway. And his van lasted about 3 weeks before every bit of his van, including the steering wheel, was shredded by this Jack Russell puppy. So they do take training and effort and time, and you need to pick the right dog. So do your homework and put the work in, but it's well worth it.
Well, you're absolutely right. And there was a warning in this research as well, or the commentary which went along with the research, saying that apparently Google searches for how to buy a puppy went up by 116% during the lockdown. So people were out there looking up.
Well, a new law came in during lockdown, 6th of April. They call it Lucy's Law. You're really? Not allowed to buy from puppy farms anymore. Dogs and puppies and kittens, you have to get them from a recognised breeder, or you can adopt them from a rescue centre. But it's, you can't just go along to the local, you know, farmyard or campsite or whatever and pick up any old puppy. It's all much more regulated.
Well, I never realised that.
So that's made things more controlled.
There we are. What other news has cropped up this week? There was
talking of things that we've talked about before and being surprised that so many people are listening. You, when we last talked about HS2, I think it was, you issued a cri de coeur to save the chalk streams. And you waxed lyrical about how special chalk streams are. And just this morning, I posted up a story on the Construction Index news pages how the Environment Minister, Rebecca Powell, I'd never heard of Rebecca Powell before, but she sounds
No, I'd never heard of her either.
Comes from down your way somewhere, I think, in the West Country. And she is... She had a meeting, looks like an online meeting, with water company chiefs and all the various environment agency and Ofwat kind of water related government people. And one of the things on top of her priority list that she wants water companies to pull their finger out on is chalk streams. And she's hosting a chalk stream summit on 16th of October. I don't know if you're going to get an invitation, David.
No. Well, I was hoping after our last discussion, I'd get an invitation to go and cast a fly on the test or the Itchen or something like that. But it hasn't happened yet. I'm not sure I'll go to this summit.
Tell us again, why are chalk streams significant?
Well, I've always loved chalk streams. I grew up actually in your neck of the woods in Kent, where there are a few chalk streams. There are none to speak of in Devon. Chalk streams are quite unique because it's water which is filtered through chalk for an awfully long time. So it's incredibly clean and clear, and it's also very rich in nutrients. Chalk streams are almost unique to England, which is, I found, hard to believe to begin with. There are a couple of chalk streams in France. The Somme is a chalk stream, for example, and there are a few up in Yorkshire, I believe. But they are very unusual and quite rare. And I think that England has about 80% of the world's chalk streams. The problem with them is that they rely on these aquifers in the chalk, and they are very sensitive to abstraction. So if you've got a big development somewhere, you obviously need water. So the water company sinks a borehole, sucks all the water out of the chalk, and it can affect the chalk streams. They can dry up. A lot of smaller chalk streams are actually what's known as winterbornes. They do dry up naturally during the summer, and they only run in the winter months.
Why are we worried about it? Why are they under threat? What's going wrong?
Well, they're under threat specifically, and actually this is why it's topical at the moment, and this is why Rebecca Powell is focusing on them. They've been identified as at risk from specifically HS2. The route of HS2 travels through some chalk landscapes, and I think that some chalk streams will probably be diverted Others will suffer from the abstraction that I mentioned. A lot of people are up in arms about this. A lot of fishermen, not surprisingly, because they are the, you know, the best possible trout streams.
But they haven't built HS2 yet, and they're already under. I mean, I know. In threat. Surely it's got something to do with lack of rain, hasn't it? Aren't you being a bit of a conspiracy theorist here?
Well, yeah. Lack of rain. As I said, they're very sensitive to the amount of rain which is soaking into the ground. I think the problem is that the planned development of HS2 will have an impact. There have been studies about this, and they have actually concluded that some chalk streams are at risk. And a couple of very high profile celebrity fishermen, Chris Packham, I don't think Chris Packham is a fisherman actually.
I can't imagine him being a fisherman.
No, I can't imagine him fishing. But he is a conservationist. He's very much against HS2, as we've discussed previously. And he has pointed out the risk to chalk streams. Fergal Sharkey, who isn't from England, as the name suggests.
He's British.
He's an Irish punk rocker.
No, he's not. He's Northern Irish.
Well, Northern Irish, yeah. He's still from Ireland.
No, it's a different country, Ireland, David.
All right.
It's like me calling you Welsh, or even German.
German's not far from the
I'm married to a Northern Irish woman, so I know about these things.
Yeah, of course you do. Well, but anyway, okay, fine. All right, then. Fergal Sharkey, the Northern Irish punk rocker. He no longer lives in Northern Ireland. I think he lives in London. But he is a keen fly fisherman, and he is incensed about the threat posed by HS2 to his right to go out and fish, I assume. So I think that's the reason that chalk streams are in the news. It's because of HS2, basically. I mean, they've always suffered from... I mean, in East Kent, where I grew up, there's a river, there's a little river called the Nailbourne, which flows into the Little Stour, which flows into the Great Stour. And I can remember back in the 70s, there was a lot of concern about that because the Nailbourne was drying up. And in its upper reaches, that's a winterbourne. It naturally dries up, but the whole sort of river system was at threat back then. And so it's always been a problem, and it's always linked to development, because the southeast of England, where most of these chalk streams are, is highly developed. There's a lot of development. We need a lot of water. People drink. We need water for all sorts of things, industrial purposes as well. And the abstraction of these chalk aquifers is potentially problematic. So I think that HS2 has become a focus for this concern. And the concern has become sufficiently widespread that now the government wants to actually focus on it, which I think is a good thing. And it was interesting to see chalk streams listed amongst the other two, because there are three topics which Rebecca Powell is going to be focusing on. Not just the chalk streams, there's storm overflows and water resources and leakages. And these are all perennial concerns. I mean, storm overflows, the whole purpose of that multi-billion pound project underneath London at the moment, the Thames Tideway project, is to do with storm overflows, because we have this problem of pollution caused by rainwater runoff polluting the combined sewer outflows and actually mixing with foul sewage and pouring straight into watercourses. So we know that's a problem. The other one, water resources and leakage, has been a problem for years, for as long as I can remember.
We talked about that the other week, didn't we, about leakage?
We did, yeah. I can't remember. How many million litres per day are being soaking into the ground? I can't remember. But
The figure is quite high. That's about as accurate as I can go right now off the top of my head.
It's always tempting to say, well, you know, it's water. We learn about the water cycle at school. You know, it comes out of the ground, it flows down the rivers into the sea, it evaporates, goes back to the sky, it rains again, and then it soaks into the ground, and the cycle continues. If it can soak into the ground, and that's why we have sustainable urban drainage systems all over the place now, because we have these flash floods caused by hard landscaping.
To bring this back to construction, what we really need, of course, is a reservoir building programme. The difficulty, though, is where to build them, because they're going to be in someone's backyard, probably, and you need them to be in someone's backyard, because there's no point building them in the middle of nowhere and then having to build huge, great pipelines through everyone's backyard, and we've got an HS2 situation that no one wants.
Exactly. Reservoirs are invariably controversial because they involve flooding vast tracts of land. And at the worst, it'll mean abandoning villages and forcing people to move out and then flooding the valley that the village is sitting in. So if they do start building reservoirs, we'll soon know about it, won't we?
Yes, but there's got to be a solution. Anyway.
Anyway, it has enough chalk streams and fishing and punk rockers and
more directly related to construction. I want to talk about machinery and more specifically how we power machinery. There was a piece on our website went up this week about Siemens Energy. They're building this big grid cable power cable connecting the UK and Denmark, I think it is, so that we can import nice Danish clean electricity. And it's called the Viking Link project, a joint venture between National
Grid. It's in Lincolnshire, isn't it?
And Danish Electricity Company. Yes, it's in Lincolnshire. And where they're building the onshore connecting-y-uppy bit is quite a large construction site, and it's in the middle of nowhere. Therefore, there's nowhere to plug in for power. And instead of using diesel generators, they've got a hydrogen fuel cell system. So they're using hydrogen fuel cells. It's a box. It's basically a 20-foot container with clever stuff inside of it. And that's providing all the power for the welfare cabins and the PPE drying rooms and the site welfare facilities and so on.
Yeah.
And the lighting, heat and power for the whole construction village. In due course, they will have plug-in electricity on site, but that's a few months away. And this is all quite pioneering and new stuff. Apparently, Siemens demonstrated the concept at the Goodwood Festival of Speed last year, and they've developed it a bit further. Now they can use the waste heat from the hydrogen fuel cell can be generated to a heat exchanger to heat water. It all looks quite cunning. I've got no idea about how economically viable it is for other people to do this, or whether it's purely a bit of a loss leader, proof of concept, it can be done first kind of thing.
But you've posted several stories already this year mentioning hydrogen fuel cells.
I knew nothing about it a year or so ago, but the first time I wrote an article for you in the magazine about essentially about battery power plant coming, or not just plant but lighting towers and site huts and so on, and solar power and alternative energy sources. I did some research on that and discovered that there is some kind of almost like theological split between those who are rah-rah lithium-ion batteries and those who go down the hydrogen route. And it seems that in the one camp you've got broadly the Japanese car manufacturers were early big people on hybrid cars, Nissan and
Prius,
Toyota,
and
Prius and so on.
Yeah.
But when we think of electric cars now, it's Elon Musk and the Tesla that leads.
Yeah.
I don't know if he leads the way in terms of numbers, but he's in the Tesla's what you think of. And meanwhile, the Japanese, Honda, Nissan and Toyota, are putting more and more money and research into hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. And Toyota brought out the Toyota Mirai, I think it's pronounced, M-I-R-A-I. I've only ever seen the word written down.
I've never heard of that.
Talk about it. And this is the first mass-produced hydrogen fuel cell vehicle that came out a couple of years ago. Elon Musk, meanwhile, he says that hydrogen fuel cells are, quote, mind-bogglingly stupid.
He doesn't mince his words, does he?
He thinks it's not viable, not going to work for all sorts of reasons. There is this split. And when I wrote this piece for you back end of last year, it looked like hydrogen fuel cells had a place as backup. Already, I think, was it Taylor Plant? I can't remember exactly who. Had produced an eco-smart zero energy cabins, which are essentially solar powered cabins, but they have, instead of having a lot of solar powered equipment, has a diesel generator as a backup when the sun's not shining, which kind of sullies it a bit. But these eco-smart cabins have got a hydrogen fuel cell as a backup. So it's only a standby thing. It's there at the edges already, hydrogen fuel cell on construction sites.
I mean, a hydrogen fuel cell, I mean, there might be some listeners who don't know what it is. The way I think of them is that it's like a battery, but whereas a battery has everything it needs sort of self-contained, you've got to feed a hydrogen fuel cell with the fuel, with the hydrogen, in other words. And it's usually a reaction between hydrogen and oxygen, and the oxygen comes from the air. So, you know, that's easy to get.
What are you feeding it with? Water? No.
You're feeding it with hydrogen. So you need hydrogen. That's your fuel, effectively. And you've got a catalyst. So it's like a battery. It produces electricity. So you got your hydrogen and your oxygen.
That's
right.
Water's a byproduct, isn't it? That's the only thing it emits.
That's right.
Is water.
And it produces water and heat and electricity. Yeah, I mean, they're very clean for that reason. The only thing that comes out of a hydrogen fuel cell is water.
But until recently... go on.
I was going to say, I think I know what you're going to say. Until recently, they seemed like... Well,
it was a
Elon
bit weedy.
Musk's description of it. Yes, a bit weedy and a bit dangerous, because hydrogen is pretty volatile stuff. And, you know, you mix it with air and you've got an explosive mixture, which I think is possibly a problem. I'm sure there are ways around it. After all, petrol and air is also an explosive mixture. But anyway, they're very efficient. And of course, they're carbon free fuel cells. You don't pollute the atmosphere or cause global warming. It doesn't need charging. It just the reaction just continues. But the disadvantages, apart from the fact that you've got this hydrogen, which is highly flammable, is you've got to get the hydrogen in the first place. And hydrogen is produced by electrolysis. So really, what you're doing, in order to get your hydrogen, you need to run a fuel cell backwards. To create, you've got to put electricity into what's basically a fuel cell, and it works in reverse,
David,
and you get the hydrogen out of
David,
it.
David, too much science. Too much science.
Sorry, okay. Well,
let's talk about construction. Machines. See, what seems to me, going back to the machines, is that whatever the complications, we always know that it's not the construction industry or the construction machinery manufacturers who are going to conquer it, because it's too small scale. It's always going to start off with the car manufacturers who've got the volume and whatever. It's going to be the Nissans or the Toyotas and the Hondas who are going to save the world, or the Volvos and the Swedish people, although they're not Swedish anymore, Volvo, really, are they? But it's going to be from that. And it seems now that it's starting to happen for construction machinery, that this magic clean energy that you've described, and I don't understand, these hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah, I don't understand it either.
Are going to come into construction machinery. You mentioned the stuff in Britain this year. March, I read a piece that Hyundai reckon that they're aiming to start mass distribution of hydrogen fuel cell excavators by 2023. I suspect they'll only be mini excavators. I don't think they'll do the full big ones, but they're looking to develop medium to large capacity ones thereafter. Forgive me, Hyundai, I should have said the Koreans are right on top of the Japanese on all of these things these days. We know Samsung has overtaken Sony in every consumer good there is. And then in July, JCB brought out a prototype 20-ton excavator, so decent size as well. And that's going through proving at the moment and for about a year. So we probably won't see that in production for at least a year, I guess. But It's proper interesting. I'm sure others are working on hydrogen fuel cells behind closed door. Maybe not the Americans quite so much, but it's happening. And the interesting thing about JCB's involvement in all of this is that it's... I think Lord Bamford, the owner of JCB, has been a little bit pro-diesel up to now. I mean, he's done some, you know, JCB, I shouldn't credit just to him, the people who got working for him, have done some, you know, good work making cleaner and cleaner engines and hybrid machines and so on. But in the recent past, they've not committed to going full way down that. They've always thought, you know, the diesel's got an important part to play, and they've wedded to that. But they have, you know, while being committed to diesel at the same time, they have been doing things in battery power, has been well reported. The interesting thing is hydrogen JCB is not Lord Bamford at all, but his son Joe, who worked for the company for a number of years, and he set up...
He does something to do with buses, doesn't he?
Well, he set up a company called it's either Rees or Rise, R-Y-S-E, I suspect it's Rise Hydrogen. So he's put his money into the hydrogen business. And he bought the Northern Ireland bus maker Wright Bus, which was, I think, was that the bus company that got screwed because Boris Johnson placed a big order for Bendy buses and then they came and then they didn't want them and then they got cancelled.
Oh, that sounds familiar, yes, so I think
they,
you're right.
They basically got shafted by Boris Johnson's incompetence, it seems to me. But Joe Bamford saved them, and he's got contracts to supply hydrogen-powered double-decker buses to various cities, including London and Aberdeen. And, you know, he reckons that fuel cell buses are going to be way forward, and then it's going to be trucks, trains, ships, and even aeroplanes. And you know, he, like the Japanese, thinks hydrogen fuel cells are the future. So this site, getting back to what we're talking about, this National Grid Viking Link Interconnector project in Lincolnshire, is a proper, interesting, significant construction site at the moment. Now, it's not got hydrogen fuel cell powered diggers on there because they don't really exist apart from these odd prototypes splashing around, but it's the it's another
The lighting and the heating and stuff, isn't it?
What's the opposite of a nail in the coffin?
I have no idea. Nail out of the coffin?
No, I mean, you know, another plank in the baby's crib or whatever. Anyway,
yeah, something like that.
Should also mention that Volvo and Daimler have teamed up. This is on the truck side rather than on the construction plant, but it won't take long for that to... they've teamed up just on their fuel cell. They're still competing in their trucks, but their truck manufacturing sides are cooperating on development of hydrogen fuel cell.
Wasn't there a company that's produced mobile lighting towers which are powered by hydrogen fuel cells? I'm sure there's somebody doing that as well.
Quite possibly, although I suspect that
I'll have to check.
Suspect my guess would be they're solar powered with hydrogen fuel cell backup again.
Maybe
would be
yes,
my guess,
okay.
But that what you're saying does ring bells. No, it's
an interesting technology. I rather like you, I had heard of them, and rather like Elon Musk, had sort of mentally consigned them to the bin. I didn't think that they were the sort of thing that people. That had much potential because of the cost, of course, that they use quite a lot of platinum in the catalysts, apparently. And, of course, platinum isn't cheap. And I just thought that maybe that was an idea which sounded good at the time, but wasn't going anywhere. So it's interesting to see that people are actually using it for proper commercial applications now, because I certainly wasn't expecting that.
Well, it's just like wind power. I mean, we start off with, Windy Miller's noddy projects, and we end up with these ginormous offshore turbines that the costs have come down, and it's viable and producing proper energy.
Yeah.
So all these things, it just takes time and development, and of course a lot of vested interest to invest in, which I suspect is where we're going to continue to have arguments between the. I mean, it seems to me, from what I understand it, the Tesla. What you're buying is not a motor car, but a battery. I mean, the battery seems to be the expensive part of it. And you're in the battery business rather than the motor car manufacturing business.
Yes. Absolutely.
And similarly, it's the hydrogen business. So it's going to be, it's a bit like your gas and electric cookers argument all over again. Do you go gas or do you go electric?
Yeah, quite. One thing about this Viking Link interconnector, by the way, I mean, we'll be importing electricity from Denmark, you say. Is it wind energy? They're big into
wind energy,
aren't they?
Wind energy, yes.
Yeah, it would be a bit of a shame if it was sort of coal-fired stuff that this was all working towards. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll watch that one with interest then. Hydrogen fuel cells.
Yes, we'll see where it goes. But it looks like it looks like the wind behind it. Use mixed metaphors again. It's got an interesting future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, is that it then, Phil? Have we come to a natural conclusion, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's enough about hydrogen, David, and we've certainly produced enough carbon dioxide. So I'm going to go outside and get some good old-fashioned oxygen and walk the dog.
I'm going to take the dog out. Yes, absolutely. That's what I'm doing when it stops raining.
Oh, it's beautiful here. Anyway, thank you everyone once again for listening to Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast. We're here every week. Tell your friends, leave us a review, sign up, email us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk, and we'll be back next week. Cheerio.
Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith and independent newsagents UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.